All right, so we're starting a new chapter tonight. We're in Revelation chapter 14. In fact, this lesson sheet that you have covers both chapters 14 and 15. And John has, up to this point, revealed to us the triad of enemies that are facing God's people. We have the ancient enemy, which is the dragon, Satan. We have the sea beast, who is the political enemy, which is Rome. And we have the land beast, which stands for apostate, the apostate Jews and the false religion of Judaism. These enemies cannot be placated, which is why God, the followers of Christ are instructed to be faithful even to the point of death. And the question, I think, in the mind of these Christians receiving the revelation and living through it is, can the church survive? Can we survive this onslaught? And that is what John undertakes, I think, specifically to answer here in chapters 14 and 15. The power of heaven is greater than the power of these three enemies. And the Jews, like Elisha's servant, who he sees the enemy all surrounding Elisha, and Elisha's not worried, and he says that those that are with us are greater than those with them. This is in 2 Kings chapter 6 and verses 15 through 17. And so Elisha prayed that the servant's eyes would be open, and then he saw the skies filled with the armies of God. And so, again, it's kind of that picture being shown to these people here, that those that are with us are mightier than those that are with them. And then in chapter 15, we're going to see the seven angels with the seven bowls of wrath. We had the seven seals, we had the seven trumpets, and now we're going to have the seven bowls. So let's read the first five verses and get right into our study. John said, "Then I looked, and there before me was the Lamb standing on Mount Zion, and with him 144,000 who had his name and his father's name written on their foreheads. And I heard a sound from heaven like the roar of rushing water and like a loud peal of thunder. The sound I heard was like that of harpists playing their harps. And they sang a new song before the throne and before the four living creatures and the elders. No one could learn the song except the 144,000 who had been redeemed from the earth. These are those who did not defile themselves with women, for they kept themselves pure. They followed the Lamb wherever he goes. They were purchased from among men and offered as first fruits to God and the Lamb. No lie was found in their mouth. They are blameless." So as we look at this picture of what John saw, the first thing we're told here is that he saw the Lamb standing on Mount Zion. And think of all of the redemptive acts and all of the ways in which God has interacted with his people, events in the Old Testament and in the New that took place on a mountain. Genesis chapter 22, anybody remember what happened there? Abraham offered Isaac. How about Exodus 19. Yeah, well, Israel meets God there, and God speaks from the mountain to them, and in chapter 20, he orally gives them the law. 2 Chronicles chapter 3 and verse 1 is when Solomon begins to build the temple to God on Mount Moriah, which is probably, perhaps even the same mountain that Isaac was offered on. And then we come into the New Testament in Matthew, the 28th chapter, in verse 16. Jesus led the disciples out to a mountain, gave them the Great Commission, told them all authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. And then what happened to him? He ascended. So, listen, a lot of could any of these happen in a valley or in a plain? But they all happened on a mountain. And so there's something about that. And there's something here as well about that. Now, he says that with him were the 144,000 who had their names written, and he heard this sound. And if you go back to Psalm 2, and I think if you will recall, and kind of just pay attention to it, John refers to Psalm 2 a lot. Why do the nations conspire and the people rage? We saw that just a couple of weeks ago. Somebody read for me verse 6. Okay, Tim.
I have installed my king on Zion, my holy mountain.
Okay, so the king is installed on Zion, my holy mountain. Who's the king here? In Revelation. It's the Lamb, who is also Jesus, who is the Son of God. And so he is standing there and is seen as already there and ruling. And I got a couple of other passages I want you to turn to. Isaiah. In fact, one person can turn to both these, or both in Isaiah. Isaiah chapter 11 and verse 9. And then Isaiah 2, 2 through 4. Yes, let's just stop there. I'll refer to this other text. And let me move us along here to our picture of the Lamb with the 144,000 around it. If you want to take the time to count them, go ahead. Some of them are off screen. You won't see them all. So who has Isaiah 11 and verse 9? Okay, Ross?
They will not hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth will be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea.
Okay, and so here is, at the very beginning here, as we're looking at the kingdom that's being described here in Isaiah 11, that they will neither harm nor destroy on all my holy mountain, on Zion here, for the earth will be full of the knowledge of the Lord and the waters, as the waters cover the sea. And then go ahead and read verses 2 through 4 of Isaiah 2.
Now it will come about that in the last days, the mountain of the house of the Lord will be established as the chief of the mountains, and will be raised above the hills, and all the nations will stream to it. And many peoples will come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us concerning his ways, and that we may walk in his paths. For the law will go forth from Zion, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem, and he will judge between the nations, and will render decisions for many peoples. And they will hammer their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not lift up sword against nation, and never again will they learn war.
Okay. And so again, here's Zion and the people going up to Zion to get the law and this peace that exists there. The name Zion, or the word Zion, appears 6 times in the New Testament. And I won't give them all to you. I mean, you can go home and look at it by the concordance. A lot of them are quotes of Old Testament passages of Scripture. And a lot of them talk about the fact that, and we'll see one tonight a little bit later in Hebrews chapter 12, where we talk about going up, or chapter 10, going up to Zion and to that assembly that's there. So we have the Lamb here on Mount Zion, and he is not alone. We are told that with him there was 144,000. And my first question to you on your lesson sheets was give a description of the 144,000 and tell who they represent. Who wants to do that? Okay, Megan?
So they were standing with him, and they had the Father's name written on their foreheads, and had mentioned earlier, and then also a little bit further down it talks about that they were the only ones who could learn the psalm.
Okay.
And they were the ones who were redeemed from the earth, so they represent the saved in Christ.
Okay. And specifically here, I think that they represent the remnant of faithful Israel. If you go back to the 7th chapter of Revelation chapter 7, and verse 4, then I heard the number of those who were sealed, 144,000 from all the tribes of Israel. And then you read down through verse 8, and you'll see that there's 12 tribes there and that are listed. And there's 12,000 from each of them, which equals 144,000. And just as we saw the mark of the beast on the forehead and the right hand of those in chapter 13, These have the seal of God. They have the name of God written on their foreheads. So they belong to God. And what then does John hear? After he tells us that, what does he hear? Okay, well, he heard a mind. Does yours say voice or does it say a sound?
Voice.
Yours says a voice. Okay. Mine says a sound. Sound from heaven, like the roar of rushing waters, like the loud peal of thunder. The sound was heard, was like that of harpists playing their harps. And so if John is hearing a sound or a voice from heaven, we know he's not where? He's not in heaven, because that's where this sound is emanating from. It sounds like many waters. It sounds like thunder. It sounds like harpists harping their harps. And so there's power in this voice. There's also beauty in this sound. And then there's another sound. And what's that? Okay, there's another sound, and that's the singing of this new song. They are singing it before the throne and before the four living creatures and the elders. And I'm guessing that would be the sound itself. And no one could learn the song except the 144,000 who had been redeemed from the land or from the earth. So again, getting back to the fact that they are no doubt the faithful remnant. And so they're the only ones who are not only able to sing it, they're the only ones who are able to learn it. And then those redeemed ones are described even further in verses 4 and 5. And the first thing, let me just stop right there. As you get ready to read verses 4 and 5, you need to understand that this is symbolic. It's not literal. If it was literal, and I said that these are those who did not defile themselves with women, what would that eliminate it from being?
No women.
There'd be no women. So there would be no women among the 144,000. And I don't think that's the case.
And there would be no married men.
And well, they could be married, but they would be adulterous. I mean, they would. But yes, you're right, and I'll talk about that in just a second. But the point that I want to make right now is you understand that this is symbolic. And even the 144,000 is symbolic. So we're not talking about a physical sexual relationship here. And there's six descriptions that are given. One is that they're not defiled with women. And that does not speak of a sexual relationship. In fact, defiled does not describe marriage anyway. In Hebrews, the 13th chapter, and at verse 4, it says, "Let the marriage bed be undefiled." It's a holy thing with God. It's sanctified with Him. So marriage has nothing to do with that. And I think that it's actually speaking about soldier priests. And I'll give you a couple of more passages to look at. Somebody can turn to one and then another. 1 Samuel chapter 21 and verse 5. 1 Samuel 21, 5. And then 2 Samuel, I'll just have you all turn over to 2 Samuel 11. We won't read it, but we will refer to it. But first of all, 1 Samuel 21 and verse 5. Who has that? This is when David is trying to get some food for his soldiers from the priests at Nob. Go ahead, Randy.
If I can just turn this one page. Then David answered the priest and said to him, "Truly women have been kept from us about 3 days since I came out, and the vessels of the young men are holy. And the bread is in effect common, even though it was sanctified in the vessel this day."
Okay, and so what David is saying is, my men have been dedicated to this mission, to being with me and to serving me and to serving God through me. And so they have totally dedicated themselves. And that's how he is depicting that. And you see it very literally done in 2 Samuel chapter 11. Because in this particular account, this is the account of David and Bathsheba. He finds out that Bathsheba is pregnant, and so he calls Uriah in asks him how the soldiers, how the war is going, etc. And then he said to do in verse 8, go down to your house and wash your feet, which is just another way of saying go down your house and refresh yourself and enjoy your married status. But Uriah left the palace and a gift from the king was sent after him, but Uriah slept at the entrance to the palace. Later on, David's going to bring him back here and get him drunk and send him on his way again to try and get him to cover up his own sin. And basically what Uriah is going to say is, and if I can find it here.
Uriah's response starts in verse 11.
What, verse what? 11. Oh yes, verse 11. The ark and Israel and Judah are staying in tents, and my master Joab and my Lord's men are camped in the open field. How could I go to my house to eat and drink and lie with my wife? As surely as you live, I will not do such a thing. In other words, Uriah says, I'm dedicated to this task before me. And that's basically what we're seeing here, that these 144,000 are in a sense, soldier priests. They are keeping themselves totally focused on serving God. Now, the second thing that it says about them in this text is that they are virgins, or they have not, they have kept themselves pure or chaste. And that term is used of God's people as well in the Old Testament. And that's more in contrast to what you read about here in verse 8 of Revelation 14, where it talks about Babylon the Great, which made all the nations drink the maddening or passionate wine of her adulteries. So you have adulteries on this side, and you have those that are chaste among those that are with God. But we are also told that they follow the Lamb, which basically means they're faithful disciples, as Megan had pointed out. They just happen to also be Jews. They're redeemed, which means they were purchased by God. They are the first fruits. It's another thing that we are told. They and offered as first fruits to God and the Lamb. And there's a number of possible meanings that and interpretations we could give that. First of all, they would be that because they are among the Jews and because they are living among the Jews, that they might be the first ones to actually be sacrificed in service to God. It could refer to the fact that they're the first generation of Christians. They were the first to hear the gospel. The gospel went to the Jews first and then to the Gentiles. And any of those could fit in that as far as first fruits. I kind of lean towards the idea that they were probably the first ones that lost their lives. Again, the 144,000 is not literal. It's just talking about the total of them. And then finally, we read that they are without guile. No lie, in my translation says, no lie was found in their mouths. They are blameless. And Christians, God's people, are characterized by truth. In fact, if you go back to Ephesians chapter 4 and verses 24 through 27, after we put on the new self, just to be like God in true righteousness and holiness, the first thing he says, therefore each of you must put off falsehood and speak truthfully to his neighbor, for we are all members of one body. And in your anger, do not sin. Do not let the sun go down while you are angry. Do not give the devil a foothold. And so God's people are characterized by truth, as opposed to the children of the dragon that are characterized by lies. Again, John chapter 8 and verse 44. He was a murderer from the beginning, and he's the father of lies, and lies are his native tongue, speaking of the devil. One other passage, and just to show that it wasn't just the Jews were guilty of that. The pagan world as well, which was under Satan, was also characterized by lies. Go back to Romans chapter 1. Somebody read for me verses 22 through 24. Romans 1, 22 through 24. Okay, Lee.
Professing themselves themselves to be wise, they became fools, and changed the glory of the uncorruptible God into the, changed the glory of the uncorruptible God into the image made like to corruptible man, and to birds, and four-footed beasts, and creeping things. Wherefore God also gave them up to uncleanness through the lust of their own hearts, to dishonor their own bodies between themselves.
Read another verse.
Who changed the truth of God into a lie, and worship and serve the creature more than the Creator, who is blessed forever.
Okay, so, and that's the key verse here, verse 25. They exchanged the truth of God for a lie. And God's people don't do that. They're characterized by truth and purity. So the 144,000 again represents spiritual Israel. And I think it's spiritual Israel whether they're alive or dead at the time of this writing. Let's go over to, because this is a parallel picture of this, go over to Revelation chapter 12. I was right the first time I gave you that text. Revelation chapter 12, and I need somebody to read verses 22 and 23. What did I say? Revelation?
Yeah.
I meant Hebrews. Hebrews chapter 12. Sorry, just completely gave you the wrong book. At least it's in the Bible. Didn't tell you to turn to Winnie the Pooh or something like that. Hebrews chapter 12, verses 22 through 24, or 22 and 23. Okay, go ahead, Mike.
But you have come to Mount Zion and to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, and to the myriad of angels, the general assembly and church of the firstborn, who are enrolled in heaven, and to God, the judge of all, and to the spirits of the righteous made perfect.
Okay, so we have the same setting, which is Mount Zion, as we have in Revelation 14. We have the same people. We have the general assembly and church of the firstborn, those first fruits people. And those that are registered in heaven. So we're looking at the same scene at the end of Hebrews as we're seeing here in Revelation 14. Now, in verses 6 and 7, it says, "Then I saw another angel flying in midair, and he had the eternal gospel to proclaim to those who live on the earth, to every nation, tribe, language, and people. And he said in a loud voice, 'Fear God and give him glory, because the hour of his judgment has come. Worship him who made the heavens, the earth, and the sea, and the springs of water.'" And so we have these three angels that are going to be given to us here, revealed to us here in this first half of the 14th chapter. I had to do some more looking in verse 6 because it says, "Then I saw another angel." And another angel from who? There hasn't been an angel since chapter 10 and verse 1. It's the last time we saw an angel. But I think what he's saying is that we have three angels in this grouping that are coming, as you can see on the screen there. And this is another one of those angels. So there's an angel and this angel as well. I think he's just looking at these three, and this is the first one. We would say the first one. But this is one of those other angels. And regardless of that, what is this angel proclaiming? Okay, so he's proclaiming the eternal gospel. Which is a gospel of peace and salvation, and it's proclaimed to every person on the earth, and also to every nation, tribe, language, and people. And so it's all the Jews in the land are going to hear this, and then also all the nations of the rest of that world, and they're calling on everyone there to fear God and to worship Him. And in fact, the end can't come until that's accomplished, until that gospel is preached in all the world. So let's look at a couple of more passages, actually three, but two of them are in Colossians. I need someone to read Colossians chapter 1 and verse 6. and then Colossians 1:23, and then Romans chapter 10 and verse 18. So who has Colossians chapter 1, verse 6, and then verse 23? Okay, Leroy?
6. That has come to you in the same way the gospel is bearing fruit and growing throughout the whole world, just as it has been doing among you since the day you heard it and truly understood God's grace.
Okay, then skip down to verse 23.
If you continue in your faith, established and firm, and do not move from the hope held out in the gospel, this is the gospel that you heard and has been proclaimed to every creature under heaven, and of which I, Paul, have become a servant.
Okay. So again, and when you say every creature under heaven, it didn't go to the Amazon, it didn't come to the United States or the Americas. It's talking about that world, where the Roman Empire is, basically. But Paul says in two times in Colossians there that gospel has gone through that whole area. And then who has the passage there in Romans chapter 10 and verse 18? Okay, go ahead.
But I say, have they not heard? Yes, verily. Their sound went into all the earth, and their words unto the ends of the earth.
Okay, so... So Paul is saying, the gospel had to go out. Who believed? They have to believe. They have to have a preacher. But he says there that their voice has gone out into the whole earth and their words to the end of the world. So despite the efforts of the dragon, despite the efforts of the sea beast and the land beast working with him, they have succeeded. They have succeeded in preaching the gospel throughout that known world. And so it began in, as Jesus said in Acts, the first chapter in verse 8, in Jerusalem, out of Zion, Isaiah chapter 2, and then into Judea, and then outside the borders of Judea, into Samaria, and then to where? The uttermost part of the earth, the rest of the world. And so it went on to every nation, tribe, and tongue. And the message again was the everlasting gospel, and specifically that message was to fear God and give him glory, because the hour of judgment has come, and that they should worship him who made the heavens, the earth, and the sea, and the springs of water. So it's a message of peace and reconciliation. It's also a message of about God and how great he is. If we go back to the book of Acts, Acts chapter 14 and verse 15,
Friends.
Yes, go ahead.
Friends, why are you doing this? We too are only human like you. We are bringing you good news, telling you to turn from these worthless things to the living God who made the heavens and the earth and the sea and everything in them.
So here they were in Lystra and Derbe, and the people were trying to, they were crediting them with being Zeus and being Hermes, the messenger of the Greek gods. And Paul and Barnabas said, why are you doing this? What we're here is to tell you is the good news, the gospel, and about the God who sent that, not these idols, but the true God. And then also, if you look in the 17th chapter of Acts, where the famous sermon by Paul to the Athenians is found. And, I turned over to Revelation 17 and I'm looking all over for Athenians and I can't find any. I should have just turned one page in my Bible where I was before. The God who made, verse 24, the God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth and does not live in temples made by hands. So here's the true God that you need to be listening to, and he is not served by men. Has he needed anything? He's the creator in verse 26, and God did all this so men would seek him and perhaps reach out and find him, for in him we live and breathe and have our very being. And in fact, that's going to open up the opportunity for Paul to actually share and preach the gospel to them. And it goes on down. You can read on down through verse 31 on that. So this is the spread of the gospel. This is the first angel. This is that message that's being brought. Okay, then we get to verse 8 of Revelation 14. And it says, a second angel followed and said, Fallen is Babylon the Great, which made all the nations drink the maddening wine of her adulteries. So this is another angel, a second one that followed with another message. And the message is fallen. Fallen is Babylon, that great city. And mine just says, fallen is Babylon the Great. Now this is the first mention of Babylon in the book of Revelation. But it's very possible, and I would say probable, that the readers may well have understood him to mean Jerusalem. Go over to, somebody read 1 Peter chapter 5. 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 13. I think it's the next to the last. It's the penultimate verse in 1 Peter. Who has that? Okay, Ross?
She who is in Babylon, chosen together with you, sends you greetings, and so does my son, Mark.
Okay. So, Peter, in his first epistle, sends greetings from the church where he is, and the church where he is, he refers to as Babylon. Now, some say that's Rome. We have no biblical evidence that Peter was in Rome. But we have plenty of evidence that he was in and around Jerusalem. Let's just kind of go peruse through this real quickly in the book of Acts. Acts chapter 8. This great persecution that arose against the church and Jerusalem. And everybody was scattered except the apostles. So the apostles were still there. In the 12th chapter of Acts and verse 3, we have Peter's escape from prison. In verse 3, when he saw that this pleased the Jews, Herod proceeded to seize Peter also. This happened during the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And when he gets out, he's going to go to the home of John Mark, who lives in Jerusalem. When we get over to Galatians chapter 1, Galatians chapter 1 and verse 18, after Paul's conversion, he says, then after 3 years, I went up to Jerusalem to get acquainted with Peter and stayed with him for 15 days. Well, Paul wasn't converted until after the scattering, and then there's going to be 3 years that he's going to spend in Arabia, so and the scattering is going to take about 5 years for that to occur from Pentecost till then. So we're 8 years after Pentecost. Peter is still in Jerusalem at that time. And then in chapter 2, verses 1 through 9, I'm not going to read that entire part there. It is talking about 14 years later, he went up to Jerusalem, this time with Barnabas. And again, he's going to meet Peter and see him there. And so Peter is in and around Jerusalem, and in fact, in 1 Peter chapter 5 that was just read at the end of verse 13, it says, and Mark, who is with me, sends you his greetings. And Mark's home was in Jerusalem. So it seems to me that this is probably referencing that Babylon is talking about Jerusalem. Listen, when we get to chapter 17 and 18, I think you'll probably be overwhelmed with the evidence that Babylon here is Jerusalem. Yes?
But why would they be referring to it as Babylon? I'm just trying to get the...
Jerusalem? Yeah. Because it's the center of the idolatry of Judaism. And so it'd be like a preacher is in Nevada, and he said, those who are in Sin City greet you. You would know that he's in Reno or Las Vegas, but that we are saints here in this place. And Babylon is a It's a metaphor for wickedness, for oppression of God's people. And so that would be the reason. So what I want us to look at here is, let's go back to Revelation 14. And if you'll notice in verses 6 through 7, we have the declaration of the gospel. And then in verse 8, we have the destruction of Babylon. It's the fall of Babylon. If you go to Matthew chapter 24, and Matthew 24 is a chapter that's discussing the destruction of Jerusalem. And let's begin with verse 14. Jesus said, "This gospel of the kingdom will be preached in the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come." What did we just read about in chapter 14 of Revelation, verses 6 through 8? Where was the gospel going? Everywhere. And then Jesus said, then the end will come. Then you go up to verse 2 of Matthew 24. And Jesus said, "Do you see all these things?" He asked. "I tell you the truth, not one stone here will be left on another. Everyone will be thrown down." And so we have the spread of the gospel that's going to precede the destruction of Jerusalem. And here in Matthew 24, we have the gospel in verse 14 is going to be preached before what he talked about in verse 2 takes place. And so again, that's the parallel there of Revelation 14 with Matthew 24. And the reason for that, the reason she's going to be destroyed, if you go back to Revelation 14, is because she made all the nations drink, and my translation says, the maddening wine of her adulteries. Some of your translations will have, because of the passion of her sexual immorality. And again, this is going to be spiritual unfaithfulness. This is why Babylon has fallen. And let's hear from a few of you, different translations of verse 8. Randy, you have the New King James?
Yeah.
Will you read that for me?
"And another angel followed, saying, Babylon is fallen, that great city, because she has made all nations drink of the wine of the wrath of her fornication."
Okay, so the wine of her wrath of her fornication. Does anybody have New American Standard Bible? Okay, Mike?
Fallen is Babylon the great, she who has made all the nations drink of the wine of the passion of her immorality.
So you have, again, the passion of her immoralities. Do you have a different one?
No, I had passion. I have the New English Standard.
Okay. Anybody else have a different one? Mike, as I said, the new the NIV has drink the maddening wine of her adulteries. The Greek word here for wrath is a word that means heat, which is where you're all getting the word passion that's being translated out of that. Passion has to do with inflaming lusts, inflaming the lusts of men. And that, in essence, the Babylon and the land beast here is seducing men to follow other gods, and the other god that they're trying to get them to serve is the beast of Rome, the sea beast, to worship him. And that's what we saw in chapter 13. Now, let's go over to Romans chapter 2. Well, I'm going to finish this section. We'll finish verse 8 tonight. Romans chapter 2, in verses 19 and 20, describes what God wanted out of his people, wanted out of the Jewish people, what he was seeking from them. Somebody want to read that for me? Romans 2, do you have that, Henry?
Yes.
Romans 2, 19 and 20.
"And if you are convinced that you are a guide for the blind, a light to those in darkness, an instructor of an ignorant of the ignorant, a teacher of the immature, having the embodiment of knowledge and truth."
Okay, so just taking that out of the if there, This is what God wanted them to be. He wanted them to be a guide for the blind, a light for those who were in the dark, an instructor of the foolish, a teacher of infants, because they had the law and they had the embodiment of knowledge and truth. That was what God wanted them to be. Instead, you look at verse 24, instead of being that, Paul says, God's name is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you. God has not been given any glory. And in fact, they have removed God's glory because they didn't accept the law, they didn't accept Moses, they didn't accept the God who sent Moses. And so God's name has been blasphemed. I've had you, and we will see this again. In fact, we'll see this coming up when we get into Acts, the second chapter. If you can picture the Roman Empire and the world of that time, where is Canaan? Where is the land of Canaan, where God promised Abraham and that I'm going to give you this land? Where is it? It's right in the middle. If you're going from the north and you're going to the south, or you're going from the south and you're going to the east, there's this huge, gigantic desert right here that's called the Saudi Arabia, the Arabian Desert. You can't cross that. In fact, the Fertile Crescent, as it comes down, right in the middle of it, is God's people. And it's just a little narrow passageway. So anybody that's traveling in the old world is going to go through there. And when they go through there, who are they supposed to see? They're supposed to see God. They're supposed to see a people who, weirdly enough, only work 6 days a week. Every seventh year, they don't plant their fields. And this God that they have blesses them, and they're strong, and they only have one God. And he wanted them to be this instructor and this teacher and this example, this light. He put them right there for a purpose. And instead, they're causing God's name to be blasphemed. In essence, he placed them in the middle of the world to be Lady Wisdom, to be the wisdom that you read about in the first 2, 3, 4 chapters of Proverbs. You know, gain wisdom, look at wisdom. God, she was there when God created the earth. That's who they were supposed to be. And instead of Lady Wisdom, according to Revelation, turned out to be a harlot. Just the opposite. Now, one other passage and then we'll quit. Isaiah chapter 1. Isaiah chapter 1 and verse 21. God says, see how the faithful city has become a harlot. She once was full of justice, righteousness. Righteousness used to dwell in her, but now murderers.
What verse were you reading?
Verse 21 of Isaiah chapter 1.
So,
Rome was never faithful.
That's my question.
That's the point. Rome was never faithful. She can't be Babylon. She can't be the harlot. And this is Jerusalem in Isaiah. And it's the same here in Revelation. All right, so we will begin next week with verses 9 through 11. Does anybody have any questions or comments?